Today we are studying the book of Esther. It's a very interesting story, an interesting book, really, because it's the only book in the Bible that does not mention God, which is a very strange thing for a book of the Bible to do, that is, to omit mention of God. And for that reason, Esther's inclusion in the Old Testament, in the canon of Scripture, was challenged by many, thinking that any book that was so secular or that made no mention of God really does not belong in the Word of God. However, it would seem that the absence of the reference to God is a deliberate device on the part of the author. The author is obviously a believer in Judaism and in the God of the Jews, and also in the sovereignty of God. There is no book of the Bible, probably, that demonstrates God's sovereignty more remarkably than this book does, and God's intervention in history. The story reminds us a little bit of the story of Joseph, and how that all these little incidental things in Joseph's earlier life all added up to eventually bring him to a position where he could save his people from destruction, as he was elevated to a high position in Pharaoh's court, and he saved his people from, in that case, a famine, which would have wiped out the Jews. Here we have a very similar kind of situation. The setting is different, much later in Jewish history. It's set in Persia. It has to do with the safety and preservation of the Jews who are still exiled, although they have had the opportunity to return to their land, and some of them have returned to Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple with Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. Yet the vast majority of Jews still live in the regions now conquered and governed by Persia. And this book has to do with God's preservation of the Jews from a plot to wipe them all out by a high Persian official. So that, as in the days of Joseph, the Jews in Esther's day were threatened as a race with near extermination. And through circumstances quite remarkable, a lowly Jewish girl was raised up to a position of high rank in the government. And she and her cousin, or uncle, not entirely clear the relationship Mordecai bore to Esther, it's either uncle or cousin. The New King James, I think, follows the idea that he was her cousin or her uncle's son. But through this woman and this man, Mordecai, the Jews came to be preserved. And just as in the story of Joseph, little incidental things, like Joseph being put in prison with two of the Pharaoh's ministers, and Pharaoh being troubled in his sleep, and Joseph being called for, you know, as the one who can interpret dreams, and all these things work together to bring Joseph to the position of saving his people. So also, in the book of Esther, you see every bit as much of the sovereign hand of God in the minute workings of the story of Esther and her saving her people from extermination at the hands of one Haman. And although God is not mentioned, his hand is clearly seen in the entire story. In fact, it would seem like the writer goes out of his way not to mention God. Several times there's references to fasting for the safety of the people. Well, fasting in both Judaism and Christianity never is really by itself. Fasting and prayer always go together. And it seems like the author deliberately omits reference to prayer, just so that he might keep some distance from mentioning God. Now, it's not because he has no belief in God or no reverence for God, but perhaps the opposite. It's that he is so sure of God's sovereignty that he assumes it. And his failure to refer to God is simply his way of emphasizing that God's involvement goes without saying. And it's a way of emphasizing God's activity in all matters, so much so that it would be superfluous to mention it. It would be superfluous to suggest that God did this or God did that, because the workings of history are so clearly the outworking of his purpose, and no story in the Bible more than Esther demonstrates this. And if you happen to have read the book in advance of our studying it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, it will become quite evident. Now, this story is set in a time period that falls chronologically between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. I told you that the book of Ezra deals with two very distinct time period, and there is a gap of 60 years between those time periods. The first six chapters of Ezra deal with the time of Cyrus, the king of Persia, who released the Jews under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest to go back and rebuild the temple. This was before Esther was ever born. And after the sixth chapter of Ezra, as I said, is a 60-year gap or 59-year gap. And Ezra chapter 7 deals with an entirely different time period, a different generation. And it deals with Ezra himself leading more of the exiles back to Jerusalem in order to revitalize and reform the laxity in the Jewish religion as it was being practiced in Jerusalem in Ezra's day. Well, between those two periods is the period in which Esther lived. The king of Persia at the time of the early chapters of Ezra was first Cyrus and later Darius. In the latter part of Ezra, which we have not yet studied because it chronologically comes later, the king of the Persians was Artaxerxes. Now, between Darius and Artaxerxes, there was another king of Persia named Xerxes. In this book, he's called Ahasuerus. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Ahasuerus appears to be the correct pronunciation. And this is another name for Xerxes, who was the king of Persia between Darius, under whose reign the Jews completed the temple, and Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes, who gave both Ezra and Nehemiah permission to go. Now, this king, Xerxes, is not mentioned in other books of the Bible, but he is, well, I take that back. There is one verse mentioning him in Ezra. But in Ezra chapter 4, there is a single verse that makes reference to this king. But he became the husband, he married Esther, who was a Jewish girl. Esther and her uncle or cousin, we'll just say cousin for the sake of simplifying things, because we can't really determine easily whether he was her uncle or her cousin, but she and her older cousin, Mordecai, who had adopted her at the death of her parents, were among the exiles that did not return to Jerusalem. Why they did not, we're not told. It doesn't seem to be for lack of devotion on their part to God or to the cause of their people, although we can't really say. It does seem like the prophets urged all of the exiles to return to Jerusalem, and the majority of them did not. There were multitudes of Jews scattered throughout the Persian provinces, 127 provinces of the Persian Empire, and there were Jews in all of them. And, of course, Judah, where the exiles who had returned had gone, was one of those provinces too. Now, in the story of Esther, there was a very wicked man named Haman who desired to exterminate all the Jews, a little bit like Adolf Hitler. And he sent out a decree to exterminate all the Jews in all the provinces. Now, that would have included the Jews in Palestine as well. That means, of course, those that had returned to Jerusalem would be in danger, because that was one of the Persian provinces as well. Also, of course, Ezra and Nehemiah, who were alive at this time, were spared at this time. They were endangered by what Haman suggested, but were spared through the course of action that follows in the book. This story occurs about 15 years before Ezra led the exiles back, some of the exiles back to Jerusalem. And we will study that next. After we study Esther, we'll study those last four chapters of Ezra. And this happens about 15 years before that. Okay, so there's something of the time setting. Of course, the Jews had been taken into all these regions by the Babylonians years earlier. But now the Persians had conquered the Babylonians, and the Jews, in some cases, experienced prosperity under both the Babylonians and the Persians, and that is the reason why many of them stayed where they were. Mordecai appears to have had a very high position in the Persian government, even at the beginning of the story, and he's elevated to a higher position yet before the story's over. And so it would seem like some of the Jews were prospering and elevated in the Persian society at this time, and whether they remained in Persia because they felt like, you know, they had selfish reasons, they didn't want to go back to Jerusalem and give up their comforts and their luxuries in the Persian Empire, or whether it was because they thought they could serve the interests of the Jews at home more by remaining among the Persians and seeking to influence policy favorable to the Jews, we can't say exactly what their motives were, but we can see that in this case, it actually turned out that the presence of a Jew in the governmental system in Persia did spare the nation, and that's why the story exists. It also tells of the institution of a Jewish feast, which is celebrated every year, called the Feast of Purim. And perhaps one of the main reasons for the writing of the book is to explain the background of that feast. It is not one of the feasts that the Bible, that Moses commanded to be observed, but it is a feast that arose because of these events, and the Jews still today celebrate it in the month of Adar, which is February and March of our calendar year. Okay. We'll just study the story. There are times when the story is so fast-moving that it would do violence to the story to interrupt and make comments. And in most cases, comments will be superfluous, won't be necessary. It's a very clear and enjoyable story, really, because it has so much action. I mean, it moves quickly. Now, I might just add a couple of points. I mentioned there are some similarities between the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis and this story. There are some parallels. Some scholars believe that the author of the book of Esther has deliberately cast the story in language that is reminiscent of the story of Joseph. And from time to time I may point this out. There are things in the story of Esther which could have been omitted, but the writer includes because of their similarity to the story of Joseph, and showing that the significance of Esther in the Persian government is analogous to, or parallel to, comparable to, the influence of Joseph in the Egyptian government. And both of them, of course, were saviors of their people in one sense or another. Another observation is that this Haman, who is the enemy of the Jews and seeks to exterminate them, is said to be an Agagite. That is, he's apparently a descendant from Agag. This is said in chapter 3, verse 1. Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. As a descendant of Agag, he is an Amalekite. You might remember the story in 1 Samuel chapter 15, how that Saul was commissioned by Samuel the prophet, or by God, to go and exterminate the Amalekites, to carry out an ancient curse that God had uttered against the Amalekites way back in Exodus chapter 17. These Amalekites were descended from Esau, and they had been the first race to attack the Jews when they came out of Egypt under Moses. And they did so in a very nasty way. They didn't just challenge the Jews to fight. They came up behind them, and the weak Jews, who were stragglers, who were kind of behind the main camp, were attacked by the Amalekites in a very treacherous fashion. And so there was a war. And you remember Joshua led the troops out against the Amalekites, and Moses sat on the mountain with his staff in his hand and raised his hand. And while his hands were in the air, the battle went in favor of the Jews. When his hands came down, it went in favor of the Amalekites. And so Aaron and Hur stood on either side of Moses, held his hands up, and all day long, until the Jews finally defeated the Amalekites. And at that time, at the end of Exodus chapter 17, God said that he will have war perpetually against the Amalekites and will eventually blot out their name from under heaven. So a few centuries later, God told Saul, you go out and exterminate them. Instead, Saul killed most of them, but he spared the king, Agag, whom Samuel killed. But apparently some of Agag's sons survived, or at least some of his grandsons. And this man, Haman, who later threatened the security of the Jewish race, even the existence of the Jewish race, was descended from this man, Agag. Now, this is ironic, because the Jews under Saul were supposed to totally exterminate the Amalekites. They failed to do this. They were not completely obedient. And their lack of obedience led to a situation where they were in danger of being totally exterminated by an Amalekite, by a descendant of Agag. And to add to the interest, this man Mordecai, I sometimes call him Mordecai, sometimes Mordecai, I suppose Mordecai is more proper, he was a Benjamite, and his father's name was Kish, which is also true of King Saul. King Saul was a Benjamite, and his father's name was Kish. Rather interesting. according to Esther chapter 2 and verse 5. We have the genealogy of Mordecai. He is the son of a man named Kish, or at least the great-grandson of one named Kish. He has an ancestor named Kish, and he is a Benjamite. Saul, who first entered into conflict with Agag, was also a Benjamite, and his father's name was Kish. So here we have another Benjamite of another Kish who is confronting a descendant of Agag, and the tables are exactly turned from what they were in Saul's day. It is the Benjamite and his people who are threatened with extermination at the hands of the Amalekites, and yet God, of course, spares them. And I won't give away how the story ends, but these are some interesting things. The conflict between the Jews and the Amalekites continues in this story, as it were. Even though, of course, Haman was a Persian officer, he was of Amalekite background. Remember, the Persian Empire had absorbed people of many races because they had basically conquered the world, or they had conquered the Babylonians, who had conquered the world before, and so it was a very mixed racial group. After all, Mordecai, who was a Persian official, was a Jew by race. Haman was an Amalekite by race, and no doubt various officials in the Persian court were of different races as well. Now it came to pass, chapter 1, verse 1, in the days of Ahasuerus, who is also Xerxes, although he's always called Ahasuerus in this book, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all, and when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords and fine linen and purple and silver rods and marble pillars. The couches were of gold and silver on the mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with the royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. Now, here is a great feast held in Shushan, the citadel, or the fortified palace. Shushan, as it's here called, is also known as Susa. Susa was one of four capitals of the Persian Empire, capital cities. Susa was the one which was the residence of the Persian kings during the winter time, because of the having fair climate there. The other three capitals of Persia were the city of Babylon, which became one of the capitals of the new Persian Empire when it was conquered. Also the city of Persepolis, that's spelled exactly as it sounds. And there's also a city called Ecbatana, spelled Ecbatana, Ecbatana. That was one of the capitals too. So Susa, or Shushan as it's here called, Ecbatana, Babylon, and Persepolis were the four capitals of the Persian Empire. Shushan here, or Susa, as I said, was the winter residence of the kings, and it was also it was there that Nehemiah also served, according to Nehemiah 1:1. Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the next king of Persia, and later became a helper of the Jews who had returned from the exile. And also Daniel, at least in part of his career, did some service to the Persian government in that city, according to Daniel chapter 8 and verse 2. He was in that city when he saw his vision of the ram and the he-goat, which was a description of the destruction of the Persian Empire at the hands of Alexander the Great and subsequent history of the Greeks. Daniel was there in this same city when he had that vision. Okay, well, of course, Daniel was dead by this time, and Nehemiah was yet to rise, but the same city. Here was a great feast that lasted for 180 days, 6 months, And it was followed by another feast of 7 days. And the first 180 days apparently was a time where the king was showing off all the glory of his kingdom, a little bit like Hezekiah had done to his own downfall at one time. Sometimes these kings like to show off what they've got. Now, we should not necessarily assume that all the guests were there for the whole 6 months. But probably over the period of 6 months, nobles and important people were brought in, probably for a portion of that time each. And there was just a period of 180 days where he was entertaining important people from all over his kingdom and showing them the glories of his kingdom. At the end of which, 180 days, he had a 7-day feast for all who happened to be still present. And again, some description of the opulence and the regalia of the occasion. In verses 6 and 7, they all drank from golden cups, and no two were alike. They were all custom-made. They were not made from a mold, in other words, but they were all expensive, custom-made golden vessels that they drank from. There was plenty of wine. There was gorgeous furniture of silver and gold and curtains and such, and marble pillars. And it says in verse 8, and in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, which is nice. They didn't have to drink if they didn't want to. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. He really wanted to give people a lot of freedom to enjoy themselves. He didn't want anyone to feel under pressure to drink if they didn't want to, but he wanted everyone to just have an enjoyable time at his expense. In verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to the king Ahasuerus. Apparently the women didn't party with the men, but they had their own party in Vashti's quarters. She was the queen. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Karkas, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and to the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Now, Vashti was apparently one of the many glories of King Ahasuerus' kingdom. He liked to show off what he had. He liked to show off the splendor and the excellency of his majesty, it says in verse 4. And he really decked out the palace to show off what a kind of a party he could throw. And another thing he wanted to show off was his wife. She was of exceptional beauty, and he wanted to show her off to his guests. Now, the fact is, he was a little bit inebriated. His heart was merry with wine. He'd been drinking for 7 days, and therefore the suggestion is made that this was not a very well-considered request. And our sympathies, at least culturally, our sympathies are with Vashti in this. That she thought, well, this guy is just a drunk. He wants to show me off to his drunk buddies. He's just a chauvinist pig, and I'm not just a bauble for him to demonstrate like his other jewels and ornaments. I'm a person, you know. And in our culture, we would say, well, you know, I kind of agree with Vashti. But there's 2 reasons why we do that. One is, first of all, we don't understand the decrees of kings. In our society, we've never had a king. We have a society that emphasizes everybody's own individual rights. And we have to realize that in the society of the Persians, not only the Persians, but almost every ancient society, there was a monarch whose orders were enforceable at the pain of death. And you'll find later in the story that the king could just order someone to be hanged, and he'd be hanged the same, you know, the same hour. You just don't ignore the command of the king. And that's something we don't appreciate because we've never had a king. And so that's one of the reasons why we may be a little sympathetic with Vashti. We don't, you know, we assume, well, she ought to have the right, you know, to not come if she doesn't want to. But nobody has right to ignore the king in a monarchy. And so she was really out of line in this. And another reason, of course, we're sympathetic is because of the feminism of our culture that finds very objectionable a man's tendency to treat his wife as a possession or as something, an ornament to show off, I mean, this seems to degrade womanhood and so forth, and we're very sensitive about those kind of things. Perhaps rightly so, perhaps not entirely rightly so, we're affected very much by our culture. In those days, of course, it was understood that the woman should please her husband. If he wanted to show her off, well, it might not be the nicest thing for him to require. It might not be a very honoring thing for him to do to her. But as a wife, even if he were not the king, she ought to honor her husband. He wasn't asking her to do anything immoral, just something that she apparently considered a bit degrading. And she would not do it. Now, as we see from what follows, she was doing this perhaps consciously, or maybe unconsciously, as an example to the other noble women. And it was setting a bad example to them, that she could ignore the king, her husband's orders, because she happened to find them distasteful, was something that would set a precedent in the kingdom, so that other women who were married to noble men in the kingdom might say the same thing to their husbands whenever their husbands made a request they didn't like. Well, I'm not going to do it. And this is the concern that the officers of the king had when they heard of this, that Vashti refused to come and to be shown off like this. It says, then the king said to the wise men who understood the time, for this was the king's manner according to all who knew the law and justice, those closest to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Miriz, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. That's all parenthetical, telling us who it was he consulted. I might just add that the historian, the Greek historian Herodotus, confirms in his writings that the Persian king had seven counselors who were nearest to him, that were immediate advisors to him, and this seems to be confirmed independently here and in the secular writings of Herodotus. Just an incidental point of confirmation from secular history. He had these seven counselors that he consulted. He didn't know exactly how to respond to Vashti. And so he said, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law? Because she did not obey the command of the king Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuch. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes, which simply means to disregard their husband's authority. When they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials, that is their husbands, that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. In other words, there's going to be marital problems arise out of this if Queen Vashti's action has gone unpunished, because all the other ladies say, if she can do it, we can do it. And then they will bring excessive contempt, that is, they will despise or disregard their husband's authority, and it'll bring excessive wrath, probably on the part of the husband, toward their wives. And then they're going to have a lot of marriage problems in the government. so they say, we've got to put an end to this. We've got to nip this in the bud before it becomes a problem throughout the entire government. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her a royal position to another who is better than she. Now, the suggestion is a punishment that befits the crime. She refused to come before him when he requested it. Therefore, she'll never come before him again. And she will be replaced. Now, this is to be written down in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be altered. We're told also in the book of Daniel that the laws of the Medes and the Persians cannot be altered. There's also later, there's another law made in the book of Esther that because it can't be altered, it becomes a serious problem. You remember in Daniel chapter 6, King Darius made a decree that for 30 days no one could pray to anyone but him. And then we found out that Daniel had violated it, and he didn't like the fact that he had to punish Daniel, but he couldn't change his own laws, because it was customary for the Persians to make irrevocable laws which they themselves couldn't even revoke. And yet we find God's laws, God's sovereignty, overriding these irrevocable Persian laws, both in the case of Daniel, where God just shut the mouths of the lions, in spite of the fact that the Persian laws required that Daniel be thrown to the lions, God showed his sovereignty over the situation. We will find also here, not this law, but the later law made to exterminate the Jews in the book of Esther, God also overwhelms the power of that decree. The Persian laws were considered to be irrevocable in order to invest in them a certain dignity, and it basically would suggest that the Persian who made laws, the king, you know, they had something like the power of God to make laws that no one could reverse, including themselves. And yet, the God of heaven shows himself to be sovereign even over those situations where the Persians have made laws that are not in the interest of God's people, yet God still works it out. Well, here, a law is made, or a decree is made, which is irrevocable, that Vashti is to be replaced. She's not to ever come before the king again. She'll never see his face again, and she'll be exiled and replaced by someone else. And when the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout the empire, for it is great, all the wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. In other words, this will put the fear of their husbands in the wives, and they see that here's a wife, the most powerful woman in the empire, the queen, is being punished in this manner for having disregarded her husband's orders. This will, of course, make all the other wives take notice and realize that they'd better honor their husbands. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and their king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, that is, its own language and lettering, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master of his own house and speak the language of his own people. The command that each man should speak the language of his own people suggests that there were a lot of interracial marriages or international marriages in the Persian Empire. In some cases, a man and his wife might come from different linguistic backgrounds, but the command was that the household should speak the language of the husband, not the language of the wife, if it happens to be different, which would, of course, show the precedence of the husband over the wife in the family. Chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of the king Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the woman's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now, it's interesting. Verse 1 indicates that perhaps King Ahasuerus, his feelings toward Vashti were beginning to abate. His wrath had cooled down toward her, and he started to remember her. And therefore, his servants quickly suggested that a beautiful replacement be found for her. Now, this is probably due to the fact that they saw that his anger toward Vashti was cooling. He had no queen. She was a beautiful woman. He probably missed her. And he began to maybe have some regrets about what he'd done, and his servants, who had recommended that she be removed, was maybe concerned that he was beginning to have second thoughts about this. And if he did begin to show any clemency toward Vashti, that, of course, would enforce what they were afraid it would enforce, that Vashti could get away with what she had done, and with impunity, could disobey her husband. And so they quickly, when they apparently saw that the king was getting soft about this, decided that the best thing to do would be to find a very beautiful replacement, more beautiful than Vashti, to fill her place in the king's harem so that he wouldn't be getting any ideas about bringing Vashti back. So they said that the most beautiful virgins in the kingdom should be sought for and brought, and the king would have his opportunity to pick from them all. And he liked that idea, it says. And so verse 5 says, "Now in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite." This Mordecai, we later find, is sitting in the gate of the king. So he must have an office in the Persian government. He's in the capital there. And it's interesting that a cuneiform tablet has been found from Borsippa, which is near Babylon. And in that tablet, there's mention of a Persian official. He's either an accountant or a minister of some kind in the Persian government, in the early days of Xerxes, which is this king. And the man's name is Mardukhaya. Marduk is a Babylonian god, and the name has Marduk as its basis. It was probably this man's Babylonian name. He probably had a Hebrew name too, but which isn't given. But many scholars believe, and it seems very likely, that this Mordecai which is mentioned in the cuneiform tablets of that period, is probably the same Mordecai, which means he was either an accountant or some kind of a magistrate or official in the Persian government. So the evidence from the book of Esther seems to indicate this. And it's interesting to have a secular historical source that confirms his existence and his office. It certainly links this story to historical records outside the Bible. It mentions that Kish, an ancestor of Mordecai, had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, verse 6, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Verse 7, now Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. Hadassah was her Hebrew name, Esther her Persian name. Some feel like the name Esther comes from the word Ishtar, which was a Babylonian goddess, which is actually where we get the name Easter from. The celebration of Easter was originally a pagan celebration in favor of Ishtar, a goddess, pagan goddess, of course. It's not certain that the name Esther comes from the name Ishtar. It is possible, just like Mordecai comes from Marduk. But some feel like the name Esther means star, and that it's a Persian word for star. And so we're not sure exactly the meaning of this pagan name of hers. She did have a Hebrew name also, Hadassah, but we never know her by that name after this. Now Mordecai had brought her up, and she was his uncle's daughter, which would make her his first cousin, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter, so he must have been a first cousin considerably older than her so that he could raise her as a daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, that, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now, she became initially one of the king's virgins that he slept with. As we'll see a little later, he slept with each of these women one time. And whichever one pleased him best became his queen. It turned out, as we find, to be Esther who did so. But the others simply became concubines, and he never slept with them again, necessarily. They would go to the house of the concubines, the ones that he didn't pick, and they would have just had one night with the king and then lived the rest of their lives, perhaps never seen him again in the house of the concubines. They could never have another man, because that would be an insult to the king, that one of his concubines had another man later. So Esther stood the possibility of simply becoming a concubine widow, as it were, if she, like the other women, would be tried out one night with the king. If he didn't choose her, she would have just had to live the rest of her life among the concubines. Many people have questioned whether Esther ought to have submitted to this. We know that the Bible tells us to submit to government authorities, but there also are limits to our submission. We should not submit when immorality is called for. For instance, if we had lived in Germany during Hitler's Third Reich, and we were commanded by Hitler to go in and wipe out Jews, obviously as Christians we would have to resist that. If we were commanded by our own government, as people in China are, to get abortion, once you've had as many children as the government thinks you should have and they command you to get an abortion, of course you can't submit to that decree. It's immoral. And in the Bible, we find that the Jews on occasions were subjected to commands from kings that went against their conscience, and they had to resist them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego resisted Nebuchadnezzar's decree to bow down to an idol. Daniel resisted Darius's decree that would have forbidden him to pray to his God. Later we find the apostles in the book of Acts defying the Sanhedrin's demand that they not preach in the name of Jesus, because they can't submit to governmental authorities that require them to do things against their conscience. Now some have felt that Esther, though she was submitting to the king in going, she was wrong to do so, because she was basically becoming a party to concubinage. And even if she became queen, which she did, she still was simply one of many women that her husband had, and therefore was involved in a polygamous situation and potentially in concubinage. Well, of course, the Bible does not comment on the ethics or the morality of what Esther did. It just tells the story without editorializing. It doesn't say she did the right thing or the wrong thing. If we wished, we could suggest that she did the wrong thing, but God used the situation anyway, as he sovereignly does. Even when his people do the wrong thing, God often still does something right through it. Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery. That was a wrong thing, but God used it to bring about deliverance. It could have been wrong for Esther to submit to this, but we don't know. It seems, however, that Mordecai, who was a man of conscience, a man of principle, and who risked his own life in defying Haman later in the story because of his strong sense of principle, that if he had seen this as an evil thing for Esther to do, he would not have permitted her to do it. We find later on, it specifically says that even when she became the queen, she still submitted to Mordecai because he had been like a father to her, and she still followed his command concerning her moral life. So it would seem very clear that her going to the harem was not resisted by Mordecai. If it had been, she probably would have resisted it too. And if Mordecai didn't resist it, it must mean that he didn't see it as necessarily an immoral thing for her to go and become part of the king's harem. Which, of course, illustrates to us that in the Old Testament, both polygamy and concubinage were, though not ideal situations, they were not considered to be innately sinful. And there was apparently no conscience among the Jews against this at the time. And so it is not really fair for us to say that Esther did the wrong thing. There's nothing in the Old Testament that suggests for her to become a concubine or one of many wives would have violated any law that God had given. True, she was marrying a Gentile, but the Jews were not forbidden to marry Gentiles. They were only forbidden to marry certain races of Gentiles, like Canaanites. But anyway, we can't really say that Esther did anything wrong here. We might blame the king that he had so many women and took it so lightly that some of them he'd sleep with one night and then just consign them to a nunnery, as it were, to the concubines' quarters. But as far as Esther's participation, there's really no moral evil that can necessarily be stated against her. Like Vashti, Esther could have conceivably resisted the order and suffered for it, but she didn't choose to do that. Although later we see quite a willingness on her part to suffer and even die for a good cause. We see that later on in the book, that she risks her life in order to make an appeal to the king, which under the laws of the time could have caused her to be immediately executed. So we don't see her buckling under and compromising her convictions for fear of punishment. As a matter of fact, we find in her the exact opposite character. So we must assume that her submission to this order of the king did not in any way violate her conscience or that of the Jews of the time, which means that maybe we're just a little more uptight about the situation than would be called for. But anyway, it says in verse 9, "Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance, the allowance to be her special food portion. The 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women." Now this is before he slept with her. Apparently all the young women were brought in initially for initial approval. And the king liked her. In fact, he liked her better than the others, and he gave her a privileged place among the virgins who underwent for a year preparations before they would come in and actually sleep with him, and then he'd make his choice among them for his queen. Right at the beginning, his first impression of her was very favorable and gave her a very privileged place among the virgins that were being considered. Now, it says in verse 10 and again in verse 20 that Esther had not revealed who she was as far as her nationality. She had not revealed her people or kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Why? It's possible that Mordecai, who was privy to the workings of the governmental system there, was aware of this man named Haman, who was soon to rise to power, and knew that he was an Amalekite and that Esther's life might be in danger if it were known that she was Jewish. We don't know how much Mordecai foresaw the developments that later came up, but for some reason he made it clear that she would be better off not mentioning her nationality. And this later becomes important to the plot. It says in verse 11, "Every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her." It seems like he was concerned about her like his own daughter. Here, of course, she had been like his own daughter. She was taken into the palace. He didn't know how she was doing. So every day he nervously walked back and forth to get any news he could from her. Of course, he couldn't have any direct contact with her because those women who were set aside for the king were kept strictly away from all other men, except for eunuchs, who had been castrated, of course, and posed no threat to their purity. But Mordecai could not talk to her personally after this, but he would wait for messages to come. And later on, he communicated to her back and forth through a messenger, as we'll see. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months of preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations of for beautifying women. So apparently their skin was treated for 6 months, probably softened with oil from myrrh, and then they were perfumed for another 6 months. This is apparently how the kings liked their women. So for 6 months, they basically marinated their women before they brought them into the presence of the king. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. Apparently wine or food or whatever. They each got one night with the king, and they got to take whatever they wanted to have a good time. And hopefully to give the king a good time so that he might choose them. We don't know how many of these women there were, but each one got their own turn on a different night. In the evening she went. This is still generic, each woman. In the evening each one went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheash-Gaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. So the women were in the house of the women, the first house of the women, when they were virgins. After they had their night with the king, they went to another house, the house of the concubines. They were no longer virgins, and so they were now concubines. And they went to the house of the concubines, from there the second house of women. And the woman would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So a lot of these women might only have one night with their new husband, the king, and never sleep with him again, depending on how much he delighted in her over the others. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai the king's eunuch and the custodian of the women advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is in the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. This is 4 years after Vashti's dismissal, because that was the 3rd year of King Ahasuerus. This is the 7th year. So he went apparently 4 years before selecting a replacement for Vashti. During those 4 years, there were some rather disastrous wars with the Greeks on the part of the Persians, and later, of course, the Greeks conquered Persia. But maybe the reason that he didn't pick a queen any sooner than he did to replace Vashti is because he was involved in these wars and didn't have time to think about such matters. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her the queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast called the Feast of Esther for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. The word holiday here in the Hebrew is used only here in known Hebrew literature. It's one of those many words in the Old Testament that only have one appearance, and therefore it's hard to know exactly what they mean. It might refer to a release of slaves from captivity or a cancellation of taxes or of debt, sort of like a jubilee, but it's not certain exactly what it means. But the occasion of his taking Esther was such a joyful one for him, because he loved her so much and took such delight in her, that he just made it a national festival. And apparently it may have been amnesty for prisoners or freedom for slaves or whatever, but some kind of great occasion was made of it, and a special feast called the Feast of Esther was instituted, which may well have been celebrated annually to commemorate this great occasion of her being found and made the new king. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not yet revealed her kindred or her people, as we saw in verse 10, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In other words, just like when she was a little girl being brought up in his home, she obeyed him and honored her as if he were her father. So she continued to honor his spiritual authority over her life, even though she was now queen. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh. Bigthan was mentioned, as I recall, back in chapter 1 as one of the eunuchs. No, that was Bigthan, excuse me. Similar name. But this one is Bigthan. And Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now, we don't know what they were offended by, but they were some petty officials, doorkeepers, maybe not so petty. I mean, doorkeepers were charged with the protection of the king's house. Maybe they were highly trusted officials, but they were angry at the king for some reason and were in a distinct and unique position to threaten his life, because as doorkeepers, they could let people in or keep people out of the king's presence. And, of course, the idea was they would keep out people who would be a danger to the king, and they were sort of the bodyguard, in a sense, part of the king's bodyguard. And something about King Ahasuerus made him mad. We don't know what. But they decided they were going to plot to kill the king. And so the matter became known to Mordecai. How he became aware of it, we don't know. Perhaps they sought to start a conspiracy with some other servants who didn't favor it, and they went and told Mordecai, who sat in the king's gate, who was obviously some kind of an official in the government also. Who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, Esther reported on these guys in the name of Mordecai, and she mentioned him as her source. And his name was entered into the Chronicles as a man who had informed on certain traitors in favor of the king. And we're told that this was entered in the Chronicles here because three chapters hence it'll become important. Because there will be a night when the king can't sleep, and in order to help him sleep, he has someone come and read the Chronicles to him. Reading the Chronicles of the kings would be a sure way of putting anyone to sleep. And he has read to him the story of how Mordecai helped him, and then this leads to further developments in the story. But here we're told briefly of how Mordecai had opportunity to inform on a couple of conspirators against the king. This is another case in the book where there seems to be some parallel to the story of Joseph. Not an exact parallel, but you remember there were two men arrested and charged in Joseph's day with having a plot against the Pharaoh, the butler and the baker in that case, who also were in a position to do the king harm. And in that case, one of them was proved to be innocent, and the other guilty, and one was hanged, and the other was restored. But we have two persons charged with conspiracy against the king in the story of Joseph also. And it was through Joseph's connection with them that he was later elevated to office. It is through Mordecai's involvement in this situation that he was later elevated to a high office. And so there is some interesting parallels there between this and the Joseph story. It makes reference to hanging these men. In fact, there's quite a bit of hanging that goes on in this particular story. Among the Persians, hanging was not done on a gallows as we know it, that is, with a hangman's noose. The Persians hanged people by impaling them on a pole. Far more gross way of killing a person. Yeah, I hope you know what impaling is, because I don't want to describe it. Basically making a shish kebab out of a person. And this is a very horrendous, grotesque way of killing people. It is written by Herodotus that when the Persians conquered Babylon, that they impaled, I think, 3,000 Babylonian officials on one day, or 300 maybe, I forget, but quite a large number of them. And later on, of course, Haman seeks to impale or hang Mordecai, but the tables get turned around there, as we'll see. So, what we see is that we're kind of developing the foundations of the story. Basically, Esther's been elevated to queenship. Her uncle or cousin has done a favor to the king, which goes on record, but does not immediately become rewarded. And now we are introduced to a third important character, the enemy, Haman. It says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Now, we're not given any reason that he was promoted, and this may be in the style of writing a contrast to the fact that Mordecai did something praiseworthy but wasn't rewarded. But here Haman is rewarded and there's no particular reason given. It's almost as if this man is honored without warrant, whereas the Jew who has warranted
reward doesn't get any reward, at least not initially. But Haman is the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which of course means he's one of the historical enemies of Israel, one that should have been exterminated centuries earlier. But now, because Saul did not exterminate them, there is a later threat to the existence of the Jewish race. He was and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. This is not because the Jews would not bow down to officials. It's not that they were concerned about violating the second commandment of making idols or something like that. The Jews often did bow down before kings, not as an act of worship, but simply as an act of protocol. It was not considered to be a violation of the commandments of God. The reason Mordecai did not bow down apparently is not because he wouldn't bow down to officials, but because he objected to this man personally. Perhaps because he knew the man to be an Amalekite. He knew that this man was of the cursed race that God had decreed should be exterminated, and he simply wouldn't countenance this. He would not, as a Jew, bow down to one of the race that God had cursed and had slated for execution. He wouldn't honor an Amalekite because he saw this perhaps as a violation of God's stated purposes, that the Amalekites be subjected to the Jews, not vice versa. And probably because of the man's Amalekite background, Mordecai refused to bow down, although the king's command required it. Mordecai, in so doing, of course, was taking the risk of losing his head or being impaled himself. In fact, that's the very thing that was threatened to him because of this. But he was not afraid to die for principle, and he wouldn't bow to an Amalekite. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate, that is the peers of Mordecai there in the cabinet, said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" That is, why don't you bow to Haman like the king has commanded? Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. Apparently, in answering them, when they said, "Why don't you bow to this man?" he said, "Well, I'm a Jew. And as a Jew, I can't bow down to him, an Amalekite." And so the people now knew what Mordecai's race was, and they went and told Haman about it. So he became aware that there was a man who was a Jew who was defying him because he was a Jew. This made Haman angry at Jews in general. Of course, neither Haman nor the king knew that Queen Esther was a Jew. And that is part of the thickening of the plot. When that is discovered, it really changes the whole story a great deal. But at this point, Esther's identity as a Jewess is totally undisclosed. Only Mordecai and Esther know about it. But now there is an offense given to a high-ranking Persian official by a Jew. And the offense is given because the man is a Jew, and therefore the official hates the Jews and decides he wants to exterminate them all. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the king Ahasuerus, which is the 5th year of Esther's career, they cast pur, which is the Persian word for lot, casting lots, before Haman, to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, Haman decided he was going to destroy all the Jews, but he had to lay a plot, and he had to actually set a time. There would be some interval of time for him to make preparations, but exactly how long that interval should be, he decided to determine by the casting of lots, perhaps to leave the matter in the hands of the gods to determine. And he probably saw the casting of lots the same way as the Jews did, as something that had divine control over it. So he cast lots to decide exactly what would be the date of him carrying out his plan. And the 12th month, the month of Adar, was chosen by the lot, which gave the Jews 11 months, because this happened in the first month. And the extermination of the Jews was to now take place in the 12th month. So there was an 11-month interval there for the rest of these events to take place in before the disaster would fall upon the Jews. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There are a certain people
scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. He doesn't tell what race he's talking about. But there were, of course, many races mixed in, and so he might be referring to a little group of people that were there. Their laws are different from all other people's, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now, there was truth in what Haman said about the Jews. They did have laws different than all other laws, although most of the Jews still obeyed the Persian laws. It was not correct to say they don't obey the king's laws. For the most part, the Jews fit in and did obey the laws. But he was correct. There was one, at least, Mordecai, who refused to bow, which was a command of the king. He was breaking one of the king's laws. And so there was some truth to this charge. And of course, he was able to paint a picture of a rebellious race of people who could all be counted on to rebel against the king's authority. And therefore, they ought to just be removed. If they're going to be troublemakers, they should just be exterminated. And the thing seemed right to the king also. If it pleases the king, Haman said, verse 9, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those that do the work, to bring it to the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, which gave Haman the authority to make a decree and put the king's seal on it, which made it official. The son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Now notice, Naaman is referred to as the enemy of the Jews here. In verse 6, the Jews are called the people of Mordecai. So Mordecai and Haman, are treated as representative of the two sides of the conflict over the Jews. The Jews are the people of Mordecai. Haman is the enemy of the Jews. And the problem is between Mordecai and Haman. It's like these two men represent two races, the Jews and their enemies, the Amalekites. And the conflict between these historic enemies is now come to a head in the persons of these two people who are facing off. It's a power struggle here. Mordecai refuses to bow, and Haman insists that he bow, and there's a tremendous threat to the Jews because of it, because now the king of Persia unwittingly is giving his approval to the extermination of the Jewish people. Of course, the king has no idea that his own queen is a Jew, and that she would be killed also if this law goes into effect. But the identity of these people is concealed from the king. Of course, the identity of Esther and her nationality was apparently concealed too. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you. So verse 12, then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each of the provinces, to the officials of all the people, to every province and so forth. And the command is given in verse 13, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. Notice the language of the decree, that they are to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children, women, and so forth, in one day. It's almost exactly like the command that was given to Saul in 1 Samuel 15:3 about what he was supposed to do to the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 15:3, Samuel told Saul to go annihilate the Amalekites, the women, the children, everyone that breathes, male and female and so forth. It's ironic that because Saul did not carry out this very order on the Amalekites, that an Amalekite arises to make the exact same order against the Jews. The Jews faced the same kind of extermination that the Amalekites were supposed to have experienced. And it says, verse 14, a copy of the document was to be issued as a law in every province, being published for all the people that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command. The decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Haman was content, but the city in general thought this was a crazy edict to wipe out all these people. And it was a perplexing and confusing situation in the city, generally speaking. The indication is that the people of the city did not, in general, approve of what the king decreed. Of course, the king didn't even write the thing. The king might not have even been very much aware of it. He had just given Haman his ring to do what he wanted in the situation, and Haman had done these things in the king's name. Now, chapter 4, when Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes, a sign of grief, of course, and put sackcloth and ashes on his head.
and went into the midst of the city and cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the square in front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Apparently another Persian law, you can't enter into the king's presence in sackcloth, because sackcloth depicts mourning, and usually the kings like to have only happy things brought to their attention. They'd have jokers and jesters and so forth to keep their spirits up, and it would kind of disturb them to have someone bring an attitude of mourning into their presence. And so there was a policy that no one who is dressed in the clothing of mourning or in sackcloth could come into the king's presence. So Mordecai came as close as he could, but that was just the square in front of the king's gate. He couldn't any longer go into the king's gate. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Now, what they told her apparently was just that her cousin was in sackcloth. She didn't exactly know why. She apparently had not heard about this decree. Probably the king hadn't either. And so she was just distressed to find out that her cousin was mourning about something. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and to take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hatak, who became the go-between between Mordecai and Esther in the rest of their conversation, one of the king's eunuchs whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hatak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. Notice Mordecai, probably because he was an accountant of the king, knew the exact amount of the private transaction that was made between Haman and the king, that he'd offered to pay that amount. He gave the exact amount, which suggests that he was very privy to all the details of what was going on in the palace. He must have held a high position. Okay. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, and it was given at Shushan that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king and to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. Mordecai understood that Esther was in a unique position to help them, because she had the king's ear, it would seem, more than anyone else. So Hatak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a command for Mordecai. And this was it. All the king's servants and people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king, who has not been called by the king, he has but one law: put all to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. Now, Mordecai was saying, go speak to the king for us. And she says, well, the king hasn't called for me for 30 days. And there's a law that everyone knows, that no one can approach the king unsummoned. They'll be put to death if they do, unless he extends immediate amnesty to them by holding out his scepter. Now, Herodotus, again, the Greek historian, confirms that this was a policy among the Persians, that anyone who approached the king without being summoned by the king would immediately be executed unless the king granted immediate pardon by extending the scepter. So there's another secular confirmation of this policy. Apparently the policy was, again, to protect the king. No one could come to the king unless he called for them. No one could get near him, near enough to hurt him, unless he personally called for them. And if he called for them, presumably they'd be caught off their guard and they wouldn't come prepared with a weapon or something that they could hurt him with. And yet he did reserve the right to pardon them if they violated this, but he might not always do so. And Esther didn't know whether the king would be angry at him or at her for coming in uncalled for or not. So she would risk death, and she sent this objection back to her cousin, suggesting, you know, what you're suggesting is impossible, too risky. In verse 13, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape the king's palace, escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? This is probably the nearest anywhere in the book of Esther that divine sovereignty is hinted at directly. Although there's no mention of God, it's very clear that Mordecai believed that God would raise up deliverance for the Jews. God would not permit the Jews to be exterminated.
somewhere, from some quarter, deliverance would come. He assumed that it would come through Esther. I mean, he just put two and two together. Hey, God is the one who allowed a Jewish woman to be put in such a privileged position here, no doubt, to save us at this very time. God knew that this was going to happen to us, and therefore he's paved the way for our deliverance by bringing one of our own people into the position of queen of the nation to speak up to the king. And so what he's saying is, listen, you ought to consider that you're not, God didn't put you there for nothing. No doubt this is your destiny, to save us at this time. And if you refuse to do it and you try to save your life, just like Jesus said, he that seeks to save his life will lose it. He says, you'll perish. If you don't speak up for our people at this time, he said, you'll die anyway. You try to save your life, God will see to it you get punished for backing down, but God will save us through some other means. But you might as well be the hero in this situation, since you're going to die one way or another. If you back down, God will see to it that you're judged. If you don't back down, you'll be exterminated with the rest of the Jews. You can't escape just because you're in the palace. The order of the king is irrevocable. And it has to do with all Jews everywhere in the province. So he basically says you got nothing to lose but your life. And you're going to lose it one way or another. Unless, of course, God somehow uses you to turn the situation around. And who knows? This may be your very destiny. It may be that you were born and raised up by God for this very position. You've come into the kingdom for a time such as this. Many Christian politicians have used this verse to give some sense of, you know, mission to their involvement in politics. They see that God putting them in positions of political power may be the very thing that God has intended to bring some prosperity to the church, or some, you know, to promote Christian causes or something. And it may be true, although I'm not real excited about Christians involved in politics. I must say I'm glad that the arena of politics is not wholly abandoned to the wicked. I'm glad there was a Daniel in the Babylonian government, and that there was an Esther in the Persian government, and that there were certain godly or people who were converted, Roman officials under Paul and so forth, who preserved the church under their power for a while, and that there was a Constantine who, though his conversion is questionable as far as its validity, it at least brought an end to the wiping out of Christians by the Roman government. I mean, there certainly is indication that God has raised up godly people in government at times, and probably especially at times where there's a great crisis and the fortunes of God's people need to be, there needs to be intervention. And so Mordecai sees this as Esther's destiny. He says, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And though there's no mention of God in the verse, it's clearly implied that God has put you there for this purpose. Verse 15, then Esther told them to turn this answer to Mordecai. Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, and fast for me. Neither eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Then Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Now, Esther was going to go ahead and risk her life and face the king unsummoned, but she wanted the Jews to fast, and of course it's implied pray, for 3 days. It doesn't mention prayer, but fast for 3 days, and fast with an unusual intensity. It's very unusual in the Bible for a fast to be without water. Many times people fast without food, but here it was without food or drink, night and day. Again, that was unusual because most Jews fasted from sunrise to sundown, and then they could eat when the sun was down. In this case, however, it was to be a total absence for 3 days and three nights so that they would actually ingest nothing at all for that period of time, and she and her maid would also participate, even though she was the queen. Now, this was to be every Jew praying and fasting for her safety, and then she would, on the third day, go and face the king about this matter. So chapter 5, she does. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner courts of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, this is when he could have had her executed, that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So the prayers were answered. He did grant her permission to come, because she came and stood in his presence within view of him, obviously asking for an audience without him calling for her. But he did hold out the scepter, which was the only hope she would have of living. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther?"
What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half of my kingdom. Notice his extreme pleasure with this particular queen, as opposed to Vashti. Vashti had made him very angry and was exiled and was removed. Why? Because she didn't submit to him. She had an unyielding spirit to him. But you'll notice Esther has really got this guy wrapped around her little finger. He'll give her half the kingdom, whatever she wants. Why? Probably because of the spirit she had, which was the opposite of that of Vashti. She was very humble and submissive to him. And, for instance, about five times when she speaks to him, she uses this expression we find in verse 4, if it please the king, if it please the king. I once heard a preacher say that we should pay close attention to how many times, not the exact number, but just to the frequency with which this expression was on the lips of Esther. She is seen to be a virtuous wife and a virtuous woman, and one of the things that's very clear, she was not seeking her own pleasure merely, but she submitted everything to her king. And basically he was saying that not only is this a model for women, but for Christians in general, that our approach to God in our prayers should be, if it please the king, in other words, if it be your will, and that we should be submitted to the will of God, not necessarily making our demands, but like Esther, being concerned only for the pleasure of the king. And if he denies our request because it doesn't please him to grant them, then that should be what pleases us too, that our pleasure is that the king be pleased. There are four other occurrences besides verse 4 here where she uses this expression, if it please the king. Now, this request she makes is not, she doesn't initially ask him for amnesty for the Jews. As a matter of fact, she realizes probably that there can't be an immediate amnesty granted. But it says, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him that day. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And at the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? He asked the second time. It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half of my kingdom, it shall be done. Then Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to a banquet which I will prepare for them tomorrow, and I will do as the king has said. That is, I will tell you exactly what my request is then. She's putting it off. He's asked her twice what she wants, and basically she has demurred to answer directly. Why? We're not told. Why didn't she just tell him the first time? There's no reason given. Perhaps in order to raise the king's curiosity further, to emphasize the fact that she only wants, it's such an important thing she has to say that she has to wait for just the right occasion to bring it up, that it can't be lightly discussed in just any situation. And so she puts it off. When he first asked her what she wants, she says, well, come to a feast today that I prepared for you and Haman. When he asked her there, she says, well, come to another feast tomorrow that I'll prepare for you and Haman, and then I'll tell you what it is. And it, of course, not only does it give the king a chance to dwell on the fact that his queen has a very important request to make, it also gives Haman a chance to, I guess, get his plot together, as it were, which adds to the plot of the story in a very interesting way. Haman, of course, interprets this invitation to the queen's banquet as a flattery. His delight turns to horror later in the story, but he thinks he's really great stuff because the queen has only invited him and the king to her banquet. And it says in verse 9, so Haman went out that day joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand or tremble before him. He was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, no doubt comforting himself that Mordecai would get his when all the Jews would get theirs in the 12th month. And he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, all the ways in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Now, apparently he called for friends of his that he hadn't seen for a long time because he told them how many children he had. He happened to have 10, as we find out later. And he was boasting about his riches and his position in government. And apparently he called for all his old friends, many of which he'd been out of touch with, and wanted to bring them up to date on all the great things that had happened to him and how wonderful he had become. And he used that occasion to inquire of them what he ought to do about this guy Mordecai, who keeps defying him. It says in verse 12, "Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to banquet, to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate." You see what an ego trip can do to a man. He's got everything going for him. He's rich. He's elevated. He's got a big family. He's being honored. But he can't enjoy himself at all because there's one person that doesn't bow down to him. It just shows how ego begins to consume a man so much that he can't enjoy anything as long as anyone is defying him, even one individual. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, that'd be 75 feet high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it, or impaled on a pole. Now the pole was probably not a 75 foot long pole, but rather probably an ordinary pole such as was used for impaling, but it may have been set on top of the city wall or in some prominent place so that it was 75 feet off the ground so that it would be plainly visible to all who passed by. And it would, of course, just like Vashti had been made an example of, so that women didn't get any ideas about defying their husband's authority, so Mordecai would be made an example of, that no one would get any ideas about defying Haman and his authority. So this is what was suggested. In a prominent place, arrange for Mordecai to be hanged. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Well, it's obviously going to take a little longer to cover the book of Esther than I thought. It always has taken longer than I thought it would. And we're going to have to take a break here because our session is over. So we'll finish up the other half of the book when we come back.